pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mary, can we do a roll call?
Yes. Moro?
Here.
Dupar?
Here.
Glasgow?
Here.
Hartzell?
Present.
Heller?
Present.
Johnson?
Here.
Miggs? Lappert? Levine? Hilmer? Sullivan?
And we have a quorum. Okay, next up is open time for the public participation. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to comment on an item that's not on the agenda? Seeing none, I'll bring it back. Next up is the consent calendar. Anybody have any comments on the consent calendar?
Well, I do. I was wondering if the manager would talk to us about the information he received from Commissioner Glasgow. There's several things in the
minutes.
Page 3, I believe, and page 3, and he was going to get information from Commissioner Glasgow, and I just wondered if he would fill us in on what information he got.
Is now the right time to do that, or?
It's not really on the agenda.
It's not on the agenda, but it could, well, it's minutes, so I thought.
It's part of the minutes.
Yeah.
You haven't told anybody about what we talked about already?
No, really. Commissioner Glasgow called me
the
day after the board meeting.
Yeah. Tell her what. I checked in with the Ross Valley general manager, Brett Richards, and I also checked in with our council Houston, and it is my understanding that every single thing that CMSC requested has been delivered, but I did actually take the day to do it. And I contacted Jason when I was done, and I asked him if he would share that with Sherry DuPart.
And I did.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. It was just open-ended in my mind, and I'm going, what happened?
Yes, I would like to pull item number 4H and 4I.
Is there anybody from the public that wants to comment on any of the items on the consent calendar? Okay, seeing none, I'll come back. Can you please explain what H and I are?
Okay, item number H is the second quarter budget report. On page 3 of 6 of the report, it shows some of the service contracts listed in Table 2. And the bottom two service contracts are, I guess this is TAM Community Services District and SD2 FOG. It doesn't show any revenues. And I was wondering what the reason was for that.
Yeah, my understanding is that at this point in time through the fiscal year, we hadn't invoiced SD2 or TAM Valley for any services as of yet. So that would be for the first quarter. There possibly could be some invoices coming out in the this month for some work in the second quarter that aren't captured yet in this table.
Wait, this is the second quarter. This is at mid-year.
That's right.
So you're saying that 6 months into the year, we haven't performed any services under those contracts?
That's my understanding right now. TAM Valley, there's only 5 food service establishments. There was 6. I think there's only 5 now. And there's been delay on their end reviewing the permits, getting comments back on the various permits and other documents. So my understanding is that we haven't done any services for TAM Valley yet. We're waiting for them to make some decisions on their end. And it's Sanitary District number 2. I'm not exactly sure what the status of our services, but according to this report, it doesn't look like we've done much for that district over the first 6 months. My understanding is that we've identified the hotspots, that we've identified what food service establishments are upstream of the hotspots. We know who we have to regulate, but we're in a kind of a holding pattern waiting for their staff to get back to us on how to permit some of these last few restaurants.
Okay, and then
those are very small areas compared to, say, Ross Valley's area and San Rafael's service area and also Las Colinas's.
Well, SD2's FOG contract is actually bigger than RVSD's FOG contract, but whatever.
Well, I was talking about the number of food service establishments.
Okay, on page 6 of 6 of the report, it shows, it talks about the five-year revenue bond program. I wanted to know how much longer do we have under the bond documents to spend the remaining bond funds? Because it's already, we're in the sixth year that the bond started in 2006. So can you address that, please?
Yeah, this is a good question, and this is a topic that we've discussed a couple times at prior board meetings. And initially, our target was to spend all of the bond proceeds in 3 to 4 years. However, because the wet weather improvement project construction contract was $7.5 million less than what we had in the bond issuance, and we received in proceeds for that part of the program, we had a lot of extra dollars that we had to spend for capital projects. And also within the bond program, we, for the first, you know, two and a half years, we received a significant amount of money of interest earnings. And we learned from the bond council that those interest earnings have to be accounted for as bond proceeds and spent, you know, on capital projects within the revenue bond program. So in discussion with the bond council, they advised us, I think it was last year, I don't know the exact date, but that it'd be great if we spent the bond proceeds within 5 to 6 year time frame. And we explained to them that, well, we're going to implement our capital projects as quick as we can and try to expend those proceeds. And a couple of key decisions that the board's finance committee and the board have made to assist us in spending these proceeds within that time frame is that all of the asset management, which is equipment procurement, equipment repair, rehabilitation type activities in the CIP, are now being reimbursed through the bond proceeds. The first few years of the program, those were being paid for from our operating funds or from our reserves. But now that we had, you know, $4 to $5 million in interest, we had $7.5 million due to the savings on the wet weather construction. We have a lot of extra dollars, and we can only implement so many projects with the resources and due to the wet weather, you know, activities that were happening at the time. The board said, well, you can then use these proceed dollars to pay for purchasing equipment and doing those sort of activities. So that was very helpful that the board made those decisions. So probably by the end of this fiscal year, we'll have most of those spent.
I was mentioning that there's a legal requirement to spend bond funds by a certain date. That's what I had wanted an answer to. Not what we were doing, but what the actual legal requirement is.
From talking with our bond counsel, he says that there isn't a specific legal requirement. However, he said it's good to do it within the five-year time period. That way, if we go in the future to issue some form of debt and we have rating agencies looking at the agency, one thing that they will look at is how we used the funds that we received under the first bond program and how we expended those and our track record. And they don't want you to issue the debt, collect the proceeds, and hold on to these funds for 20 years and just spend them incrementally. They want you to use the money within, you know, a reasonable amount of time. He said that there isn't any specific legal requirements in our indenture documents, like you must spend these in 5 years, you must spend them in 7, but it's better to spend them within, you know, a shorter period of time. So we've had, you know, ongoing discussions with him about, you know, the expenditure of these, and we've briefed him on the and the bond trustee, for that matter, on some of the board decisions to reimburse us for asset management related capital project help, you know, use those funds.
Okay, and I also wanted to ask, I also just wanted to say kind of again that I would really appreciate seeing a regular financial statement packet that consisted of at least a balance sheet and an income statement and perhaps a cash flow, something that is usual practices for any business. And to me, it's a missing that we don't see financial statements throughout the year. Thank you.
As we've, you brought this up in the past, now we, as we've said to the board, if the board would like those specific types of financial documents prepared, we would just need some direction to do that. But most public agencies don't prepare those type of documents. Those are usually prepared by private agencies.
Commissioner Bosco?
Jason, just two simple questions. The bonds were callable when, or when are they callable?
There are a lot of different series of bonds in our indenture, and they're callable over years. And the bond indenture document that
I know we've already paid some off.
We've paid some off.
Yeah.
But that's a detail that you'd have to look actually in the indenture documents at, you know, when they become callable, when they get called, things like that.
So
we just make the debt service payment to the trustee.
Right, but I imagine the documents when they're created give a callable term. So I'm trying to figure out how far out are we with these tiered callable documents?
Well, you know, we'd have to agendize a discussion on that particular question. That way we could work with the bond council. We could review the whole master indenture document and schedule that out. But essentially, the term of the debt issuance is 25 years. So CMSA has to make the debt service payments for the next 21 years?
Yeah, we've used about four of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we probably.
But during that 25 years, there are different bonds that are callable.
Right. You mentioned 3 years already that I know we've already taken care of.
Yeah, I don't know the detail of the different series of bonds and when they're callable and what dates, but it's all in the indenture document.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Commissioner Johnson, you have a problem on I?
I just wanted to state that I didn't feel comfortable about. This issue in general about having the cost index, cost adjustment index changes made by staff instead of coming through the board.
Well, I believe that staff will be coming to the board whenever there is a change.
Well, no, that's the purpose of this.
No, they will let us know.
Afterwards.
If the board approves this item, we'd report it to the board at the during the general manager update after the adjustment was made.
Right, by staff rather than by the board, which is what I had the problem with.
Any other questions?
Can we keep that out and discuss it as a board?
No, we already did, didn't we?
Did we?
Wasn't it brought up last month?
Last month we had an item in the consent calendar where we adjusted the index for, I believe it was sodium hypochlorite, and I think sodium bisulfite. There are two raw materials that the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics no longer tracked and maintained. So we worked with the economist at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as well as the vendors, to select replacement indexes.
What's the?
It's $5.
Oh.
What's the view of the board? Do you want to pull this item? Do you need to further discuss? No. We're discussing it. We don't pull consent items. No. Does the board want to pull this? Do we want to have further discussion on this, or do we allow staff to just let us know when changes are to the statistics? I'd like to try to keep the consent calendar to one motion rather than up and down votes on each item. But if the board wants to pull this for further review.
What are the benefits that we don't have today that we'll have tomorrow if we do that?
The benefits from
us. I'm going to ask Ms. Johnson if she's proposing this. What is she looking for?
I was looking for to have the status quo remain unchanged, not to make this suggested change.
Clarification,
yes.
That any time one of these indexes or the costs change, you want it to come to the board first, and then the plant can go ahead and...
Right, have the board approve the cost adjustment, the index, change of the index that is used for the cost adjustment. If there is a change of index needed, it's not needed every year. It's just, it's an unusual thing, actually. So... I just didn't want to expand the powers of the staff in that arena.
Okay. I don't need to pull up.
I'm sorry, what did you
say? I don't need to manage that. I think that's appropriate to be handled by staff. So I'm willing to make a motion to approve the consent calendar.
Anybody second?
Second.
Yeah, I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Next up is item number 5, the annual asset management program presentation.
Okay, I have a brief overview before we turn it over to Mr. Cadro. So the agency's been giving the board presentations on our asset management program from about, I think from 2008 we started. We usually give these in the fall, in the wintertime. We give a overview of how we got to where we are with using the asset management principles and practices in our business. And we also then highlight the asset management achievements and what's been done since the last presentation or over the last year or so. So just in terms of a little history, back in 2002, when the administration of the agency changed, one of the first directions from the board was for me to bring in a consultant and do an operation and management review of the agency. So we hired C.H. Tuam Hill. They used a peer review format where longtime managers, a very successful, what was known as high-performing utilities in the Bay Area, came to CMSA. They reviewed our practices. They reviewed various documents. They interviewed a lot of our staff. And they looked at how we performed our business in our core functional areas: engineering, capital, project management, financial management, human resources, operation and maintenance of our facilities. And they compared CMSA with other high-performing utilities, or in some cases with industry best practices at the time. And one of the outcomes was a report that had a series of recommendations to it. And three of the recommendations I wanted to tell you about were: the top recommendation was for the agency to develop and implement a strategic business plan. The second was for the agency to procure and utilize a integrated computerized maintenance management system. And the third was for the agency to develop policies and procedures and the supporting work practices that align with the principles of asset management. So those then fed into our first strategic business plan, which was developed during 2004, was adopted by the board in December of that year. And there was a particular goal, number six, some of you might remember that, and it said that the agency would be developing asset management and information management programs. Then there was an objective that focused specifically on asset management. There were six or seven strategic actions associated with that, with the final one being that we would develop a strategic asset management plan for the agency that utilized the computerized maintenance management system. So we worked with another consultant. We developed that strategic asset management program that came to the board in 2006. It was adopted by the board, and we've been implementing the various 14 tactical action plans in that asset management program over the last several years. One of those tactical action plans was to give periodic updates to the CMSA board on our achievements and accomplishments on asset management. So that's one of the reasons why we're here tonight. Then, as you know, we just adopted a new strategic business plan that was approved by the board back in September, and it has an objective that states that CMSA will continue to enhance the agency's asset management program, and there's various actions associated with what we're planning to do over the next 5 years with asset management. And with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Mr. Mike Cadro, who has been recently promoted to the maintenance supervisor position at the agency, overseeing all the maintenance staff. And over the last several years, he has been a key contributor and really the leader on moving the agency forward through our asset management program, and has done a very fine job for the agency. So with that, I'd like to present Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Mike.
Glad to be back here this year. We've had a pretty good year. So we're going to go over what asset management means to CMSA, why we do it. We'll touch a little bit on the history. Jason's already covered that pretty well. We're going to take a little different look at the elements of asset management this year than we have in past years, and then introduce portable computing, which is something that we incorporated in 2011, and then talk about our next steps, where we want to go from here. So if you look at the definition up on the screen, industry by industry, this is the accepted definition of asset management. In our ongoing effort to be more efficient than everyone else, we were able to pare it down to this. In reality, asset management is cost and risk control. So why we do asset management? Our equipment's all getting older. Operations has made some spectacular improvements to the way they operate the process, which changes how we operate the assets. So we use the asset management program to be able to accommodate those changes at a time when equipment's getting older and older. it allows us to make good decisions about what to do with the assets. What kind of PM do we do? How often do we repair it? When do we refurbish it? When's it time to replace it? Gives us the tools to be able to make those decisions. We're able to capture all of the historical costs, and then with our working with the manufacturers of the equipment, determining what it takes to keep the equipment operating as efficient as possible, we feed all of that into a funding model, which greatly assists us in budget development from year to year. And it gives us the ability to manage risks of the asset failures. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but in some cases, we decide to run an asset to failure. It's cheaper to let it run to failure than it is to go and try and maintain it. Other cases, critical assets that have been identified, we need to keep them operating. We can't do without them. So, aging infrastructure, you can see a few of the projects that we've recently accomplished. Bar screens, this is our first line of defense in a waste stream coming into the plant. It takes out the debris, the rocks, that kind of stuff that's coming in. If the bar screen doesn't work, that material passes through, makes it to the next phase, which is our primary clarifiers. So you can see we replaced the bar screens when condition assessment and operations showed that they were getting too expensive to operate. Primary clarifier main drive there, we replaced this assembly. Anybody that's been on a tour of the plant, when you walk by the primary clarifiers, you see the flights that are skimming the top of the clarifier. That's the drive that drives those flights. Those same flights on the return trip then skim the bottom of the tank. So here we've got secondary clarifier gate. So if solids make it through the bar screens, make it past the primary clarifier, they end up in the secondary clarifiers. This is a picture of a gate that we've replaced this past summer. You can see here, manufacturer did a spectacular job specking that material. That's the wear surface, or the mating surface, the sealing surface when you close the gate. But what's happened here is that fits into a channel. That channel's been eaten away, so that is no longer sitting in the position it's supposed to. What happens is you get debris out running through the plant. It gets caught up behind that strip. Then when the gate comes down, it can't come down all the way. It binds. Then we get water coming through. Secondary clarifier drive, that's on the same clarifier as that gate. So we get solids working all the way through the plant. This is the device that when you walk by the secondary clarifier, it turns the arms that rotate around the diameter of the clarifier. So all of that puts additional loads on the equipment downstream. So with this program, we're taking a more holistic approach rather than looking at individual components of the processes. How we do this, the tools that we use to make the decisions and what we do. This is an example of a condition assessment form that we used. It was for the old bar screens that we had in place. Performance, well, we knew that one bar screen can handle regular dry weather flows, but in a rainy season, it required two. We did not have a backup. We went in and did a condition assessment. Operations did a risk analysis of what would happen if we lost one of the bar screens. And it was determined that it is a critical asset. It's one that we need to be able to operate when we get the high weather flows. This was done in 2007. At that time, we were just getting into condition assessment. We were just learning how to do it. So just to verify that we were going along the right path, we called Parkson in, who was the manufacturer, and they verified the condition of the screens. What this is showing us is this, the physical condition and the score, it works off of a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being brand new, 10 being ready for the scrap pile. We came up with a score of 8.4, and Parkson came in and confirmed that that was the condition of the unit. Operations determined that it was a critical asset, and the score for criticality, same scale, 1 to 10, 1 being new, is that it's a pretty critical asset. So if you multiply those two numbers together, you come up with a total risk score. So the worst score you could possibly get is 100. This one scored 73 out of 100. That was an unacceptable risk for us. So from all of that work, we determined the key issue was that the bar screens are in poor condition and we have no redundancy in the event of high wet weather flows. So the first thing we did was we formed a team to take a look at options, so we could try and determine what the most economical path forward would be. You can see here some of the options that we considered. We passed this on to that team. Another thing we did is we increased the PM. We decided to start doing quarterly PM on a monthly basis so we could keep a closer watch on it. So we could, in the event something changed, we'd be there, we'd be ready to act. So this is how we come up with the decisions or the information that we use to make the decisions. How we control costs. Our cogeneration system is one of the most expensive single pieces of equipment we have on the plant. You can see year by year, how much it's going to cost. If you don't know what it's going to cost, you can't control those costs. Here you can see in FY12, we planned on doing regular PM and then a cooling system upgrade. That was going to come to somewhere between $110,000 and $120,000. Next year, it's due for a complete rebuild. Following year, just regular PM is all it's going to take.
Is this the Waukesha?
This is the Waukesha, yes.
Didn't we just do some rebuild of some major component of it?
I'm sorry?
Didn't we just do some major rebuild of a major component?
Well, every 2 years it requires a top-end rebuild. That's okay. A pretty major job.
Okay, that's what I'm remembering.
Yeah, I think that's what you're thinking of. So we do an upper-end rebuild, or we start here, top-end rebuild. The next year we do just regular PM. Then, a year later, we do a full rebuild, and it just keeps repeating that cycle. The reason you're seeing different peaks is there are other components that make up that system that don't have to be replaced that often, or some a little bit more often, but that's why you'll see where, PM from year to year is going to change a little bit. Top-end rebuild could change a little bit, too, because there are other components thrown in there.
The elegance of having this type of a funding model, which uses all of the equipment, replacement history and labor hours to do these type of activities, is that then this funding model through the asset management program then feeds into our capital improvement program. So if we had the budget here, you could look at one of the lines in the capital improvement program, and it'll have the cogeneration system, and those dollars over the 10 years come from the asset management funding model.
So is this considered operational or capital?
These are capital activities.
Even though it's maintenance?
Yeah.
So one of the ways we use this to control the cost was we went to Waukesha and they recommended what we do. It was based on hours of operation. They told us every 12,000 hours we were going to have to do an upper-end rebuild. 12,000 hours, that puts you at about a year and a half. We've got the PG&E peak demand window to be concerned about. We can't shut the engine down in the middle of that window or we're going to be penalized from PG&E. So what we did was we watched the operation real closely. We collected a lot of information, oil samples, things like that, to make a determination. Do we really have to do those tasks at 12,000 hours or can we spread them out a little bit? And we determined through all of that analysis that we were able to go 16,000 hours in between those rebuilds. That was ideal for us because it put us in between the windows, so we didn't have to be concerned about penalties from PG&E. So we were able to space this out. Though going through that analysis, it extended the life in between those intervals by 4,000 hours, so we saw some savings there. Also, we didn't just automatically stop and do a rebuild based on the manufacturer's recommendation, which, as it turned out, we didn't need to do that often. So we take all of this information and use it in a lot of different ways to make the determinations that we do.
Do you ever talk to other owners of like equipment?
We do. We've made trips to other plants. Other plants have come to see what we're doing and how we're doing that. I go to the BACWA maintenance quarterly meetings. We talk about issues of the day, and we have an open period where we can talk about things at our particular plants. So we have gotten a lot of input from other plants. We've gotten a lot of help with this whole program from outside the plant. Even the whole asset management program. I've been to workshops. We go to the conferences. And, I've learned this stuff from the top people in the field. So it's, we've had some really good teachers help us with this. So how do we use it to manage risk? You take a look. This is the probability or the physical condition. This is the consequence or the criticality of the assets, and that's a scale of 1 to 10 on each axis. Agency vehicle is a good example of an asset that low probability that it's going to fail. Even if it does fail, it's really not going to affect us too badly. It's not going to hurt us. We're going to do a regular PM on it, but we're not going to put a lot of other attention into agency vehicles. A bathroom exhaust fan, it's cheaper to let it run to fail than it is to go and try and do PM, you know, keep it clean, keep it oiled. It doesn't pay to do that. So we're going to let that run to failure.
Yeah, spoken like a true guy.
It's like a bathroom cleaning too.
Yeah.
The force main, high consequence if it fails, but very low probability. So, you know, we'll monitor it, we'll keep an eye on it, but we're not going to put a lot of other effort into it. The bar screens, those high probability of failure because of the condition that it was in, and a very high consequence if it does fail. So that was raised to the top of our priority list. That's how we use the program to manage our risk. So the bottom line here is the risk drives the activities that we do.
Would keeping extra parts or reserve pieces,
that plays
would that help
that
with
is a part of it.
Some of the consequence?
One aspect of this is we call it critical spares.
Okay.
We keep critical spares on the shelf. You know, it would be nice to have a spare everything,
yes.
But there's just a certain amount of money that we have to spend, so we have to be smart about what we put in stock. So we use this to make that determination. What are we going to buy? What are we going to keep on the shelf?
Our staff has done a full inventory of all of our assets. And there's, what, 2,600 assets in the agency? And they've looked at those 2,600 assets. Then they identified which one of those are critical assets using various criteria. Then of those critical assets, what are the spares that you need to have on the shelf in case that critical asset, you know, fails? They've done a very good job, you know, identifying those and keeping that inventory on hand.
So you establish minimum stock levels of your critical
equipment,
and then the computerized system, maintenance management system, will identify we need to reorder it too.
That's correct.
Right, always make sure that those numbers are accurate in queue.
That's right. Another thing we did is we went to some of our vendors, and you know they're hungry for business, especially with the way the economy has been recently, and convinced them that it was to their benefit to stock some of this stuff for us. So we didn't have to put those dollars off, but we could be ensured that they're on the shelf closely enough that we could get it in a hurry. So some of the critical spares we keep on the shelf here. Some of them are kept at the vendors. Some of them are still on our wish list, and we'll get them over time.
That's neat to go into their pockets and spend that
money. They're probably giving you some decent prices for being able to guarantee, basically, that you'll be getting some more equipment from them, too. So.
We've been very successful in pricing. I'll give you a good example, Desert valves. You know, a 12-inch valve, at one time we were paying over $2,000 a piece for them. Now we've been able to negotiate that down to $1,200 a piece. So across the board, between 6, 8, 10, and 12-inch valves, the average reduction in cost to us is 40%.
That's great.
So
that's wonderful.
It really has paid off in a big way. I mean, it's taken a lot of effort to get to this point, but we're seeing.
I remember when you first introduced all this, and I just love all this, by the way. Yeah. This is one of my favorite presentations of the year.
Oh,
just
thank
so you.
You.
Know.
Put that in minutes.
It's nice to show it off once in a while. You know, we work real hard on it over there.
You
but
definitely see that you've progressed from just starting to.
And this is the next generation of the next gen, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I went to WebTech and went to one of the workshops, and now they're talking about the next phase of asset management and, you know, where it's headed from here. Yeah. And, you know, just when you think you're done.
The robots will go out and do it.
Yeah, there you go. So Jason captured the history pretty well. I'm not going to spend much time here, but from 2002 to 2004, we purchased the CMMS. We developed the first strategic business plan. In 05 and 06, we developed and implemented the first strategic asset management plan. Then in 2007, we were smart enough at that point. We had learned enough that we were able to go back and take a look at the data that we were collecting and how we were using it, and we realized that there were potential improvements that we could make. So in 2008, we evaluated all of the data that we had. We looked at what data we needed in order to dive off into that asset management pool and fine-tuned our CMMS. In 2009, then, we purchased a new program because it had the asset management module. The previous CMMS didn't have that. So at that point in 2009, we had a program that had everything involved, you know, the CMMS, all of the modules, and the asset management included. Every module talked to each other, fed each other. It made it much easier to manipulate the data that we were collecting.
And that's the next-gen software that Commissioner Guasco referenced.
2010, then, we implemented the asset management software fully. We started playing with it in 2009. In 2010, we had next-gen fully functional. 2011, we introduced portable computing, and I'll show you in slides coming up why we did that and what that did for us. So last year, you probably remember, we did elements and tools of the asset management program. At the end of 2010, this is where we stood. And we felt pretty good about where we were. The asset inventory module was complete. We had our asset tree in place the way it was supposed to be. We had that module functioning as well as it could, given where we were with the CMMS. Sorry. So the CMMS module, which includes the work order, the inventory, we had those talking to each other. We started using a purchasing module, which closed that loop. We could use the purchasing module to make purchases. When the purchases were received, the inventory module would be automatically updated. When a part was put onto a work order, it would be automatically taken out of the inventory module. It automated all of the things that we were doing. We felt pretty good at this point. But then, knowing that asset management was just around the corner, we had to take a look at what do we need to do now to complete the picture. First thing we need to do is condition assessment, because as good as CMMS was at collecting the historical information, we needed to know what condition the critical assets were in so we could make a determination of what we were going to do, how long they were going to last, and then what we were going to do to replace them with identical, replace them with other technologies, or what we were going to do at that point. So the next thing we did was go after condition assessment.
And how often do you relook at or reassess the condition assessment?
Anytime we do a work order that changes the condition of the asset, we'll go ahead and update that information. I'll talk on the next slide about how we actually do condition assessment, and that question will be answered there. So the next thing we did was look at condition assessment, how we were doing it, and what changes we needed to make to do it fully. Our rehab program, which you know we called asset management program at the time, but really that was maintenance repairs. We had a CIP, but there was a gap between the two because we had some maintenance repairs that were quite costly. We had some projects that could be considered capital, but you know didn't cost quite as much. So we had that gap. We weren't really quite sure what to do with that. We had the funding model available to us, but we weren't. All we were feeding into it was just historical information. We didn't have any of the planned for any of the assets. So the funding model was halfway there, but not quite where we needed it to be. And then the geographic information systems, you know, it was a big part of the program. It's really designed for linear type assets where you have pipelines and manhole covers. You need to identify areas there. That's what it was designed for, but we saw some opportunities there also. So end of 2010, we get into 2011. This is where we started 2011. And like I said, we felt pretty good about being this far along. Many plants our size never make it to this point, and it's because they don't do this part of it fully. You don't collect the right data, you get garbage coming in, you're going to get garbage coming out, and that's where most people fail. At this point, we were successful there. Next thing we did was condition assessment. What we did there was, when you go to do condition assessment, you need access to the whole system. You can't typically get that when the processes are online. We do annual summertime PM, where operations would give us access to complete systems. We decided to incorporate the condition assessment with our PM program, which took a little bit longer to get the PM done, but gave us some excellent information that we fed into the system. We combined the rehab and the CIP programs. We formed a multidisciplinary team, somebody from each one of the different departments, and now all the decisions are made there. That team is headed up by our senior engineer. So we closed that gap that we had before, and now everything goes through that team before it becomes a real project, whether it's on the maintenance side or on the capital side. The funding model just kind of fell into place at that point because we had the good condition assessment information, and we started getting not only the historical, but we were able to predict the cost out into the future. All of a sudden, the funding model began working for us. And then the GIS, we saw opportunities out on our landscape. You know, we spend a fair amount of money on landscaping. We have a big grounds here, different problems in different areas. You know, we had this sudden oak disease. We wanted to document that. We have areas where we spray for different things. We wanted to document that. So we use GIS now to identify trees that we take out, to identify areas that we sprayed or that we've treated, where we do different work. So we can pull a Google Earth map down of the facility and see, you know, where we've treated with chemical, that's all color-coded. We can see that on the map. Where we've cut a tree, we've got the coordinates right there. We can tell you where that tree is. So you ever want to come and find out where the landscape money's going, I can show you. So at this point, we could have patted ourselves on the back and gone home and felt pretty good about what we had accomplished, but we had spent so much time trying to get each one of these things working, we finally got to that point, we realized there was another opportunity for improvement, and that was portable computing. What we did is we took a tablet PC, and initially we decided that, you know, I'll tell you how it really happened. Sorry, Jason.
Behind the scenes.
I don't even know about this part of it. I'm taking notes now.
Yeah. Well, we were looking for some information in a stack of paper one day from log sheets that had been collected. Log sheets were filled out beautifully, but when you have a stack of them and you're not quite sure, you know, you're sifting through. So we thought it would really be nice if we could store this information electronically to make, you know, keyword searchable or make it much easier to find that information. So we started looking at ways to do that. We got a tablet. Some of the advantages of the tablet are we are able to now collect that information electronically, store it electronically, and pull it up at will. I can be out filling out a log sheet at a pump station, and Chris can be back here at the plant looking at his terminal and see the changes or the input that I'm putting in there. So it's live coming back to the plant. With the inventory system, work orders and the purchase order processing, it really streamlined that process. We're going to look at some pictures in the next couple of slides that are going to really demonstrate that. The biggest thing for me was this one. You know, I haven't been at the plant that long. I wasn't here when it was new like some of the others. We've had some people retire recently that, spectacular people, incredible amount of knowledge, but we weren't able to capture all of that knowledge. This is a tool that we can use to do that. We've got blogs that we've set up now for assets on the plant and for the pump station, so keyword searchable. So events happen, it's really easy to find information that you're looking for.
Next thing you know, the plant's going to be twittering.
Yeah. No, we'll be operating it from home. And the robots, we'll be controlling the robots.
Cleaning the bar screens.
There you go.
Well, you kind of could in a lot of ways, you know, already. So.
Yeah. So it enables access to CMMS, SCADA, and our CMSA network, which really enhances our ability to monitor and troubleshoot remotely, which in the past has been a bit of an issue for us. Here's a picture of it. We settled on the Samsung Galaxy. That's a picture of our SCADA screen. And you can see on this side, you know, these are just tabs. We can go to any part of the process. We can pull up alarms that are active. Operations has the ability to change set points, to acknowledge alarms, to reset alarms. Everything is time and date stamped. We see exactly who's doing what on there. But this is a device that we settled on. Here's where it all started, the pump stations. And our goal was just to be able to manage the data that we were collecting and be able to pull it back at will. So we started just doing rounds. We found out right away, once we were able to see SCADA, that assisted in troubleshooting. Many fewer calls to the plant to ask what's going on at a pump station when we're trying to troubleshoot. Saved us a lot. Then we started looking at other opportunities within the plant. Here you can see one of the environmental services inspectors inspecting the grease trap. These devices also have a camera. So if she were to see something there that she wanted to document, she could snap a picture. It comes live back to the plant. So our environmental services manager can see live what she sees and what she's doing. Our hazardous waste inspections, 5 days a week. That's five pieces of paper a week that are going into another file. So we now do it on the Galaxy. It stores all of it. It talks directly to our CMMS. It stores all that information. Auditor comes in or anybody has any question about what we've done over the course of the year, we can, from any terminal in the plant, pull that information out.
Does it do video as well as pictures?
It does video also. That's okay. Correct. We haven't done a lot of video because of the amount of storage space that it takes.
Yeah.
But we, in our condition assessment, we have used and we're storing videos, like the sluice gates especially, you know, where we can show how much they're leaking when they're closed, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we are using video. Rounds, you know, operations twice a shift does rounds. That's six times every 24-hour period. You know, prior they were carrying a clipboard around with them, filling out a piece of paper, and then sitting down and manually entering that someplace. We wanted to eliminate all of that.
Your paper process is reduced substantially, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Inventory control. This was a big one. Auditors want us to do a physical inventory every year. It would take two guys 2 days to do that here.
These are financial auditors.
Yes.
Prior to using the tablets. Now he can pull up the inventory on the screen. He can check quantities from where he's at, adjust quantities right there on the screen, where before he'd have to print out hard copies, mark it up, come back and sit down. And the numbering system, the way it was, you know, everything wasn't in order in the system according to how it was put away. So there was a lot of shuffling of paper.
Is barcoding scanning?
Everything is barcoded.
Oh, cool.
You can, on the picture right below there, you can see on the purchase order processing, you know, prior, we'd fill out a purchase order, the order would come in, we'd open the box, we'd compare that to what the packing slip said, what the purchase order said we were supposed to receive, all manual steps. Sit down at the computer, adjust the inventory quantities. It was pretty time-consuming. Now, he pulls the purchase order up on the screen, he compares that to what's in the box, he clicks one box to receive the purchase order, and at that point, a label printer prints out all of the labels for everything that was on that purchase order.
In terms of accounting internal controls, can anybody just go in and say, the inventory says there's supposed to be six, what's on the shelf, but there's only two?
No, we set, and that's actually done through our CMMS. We set access rights for individuals.
Right.
Some
okay.
people have a little higher level of access than others.
So for security purposes.
For security.
Okay.
Also, you have to log into the device. Otherwise, you can't make any changes. All you can do is see the screens. So, and it time and date stamps every action that you take while you're using the while you're logged into the device.
What about back orders? Do you not accept orders if there's back orders, or do you keep track of back orders?
We have a tab that is partially received, so we can partially receive items the same way. And then the PO then automatically goes from approved to partially received. If it's completely received, then it goes from approved directly to received. So on the barcode, or I mean on the label then that prints from that label printer includes a barcode for the part, the bin location, so he knows where it goes, the vendor part number, you know, other information that we use, you know, the date that it was purchased, you know, that kind of thing.
And did the employees like how was the acceptance? Morale of, you know, making them use this new device. Was it, oh, good fun, new toy,
well,
or was it,
you know,
I want to do it the old way?
That's one of the reasons most plants fail, is because they can't get buy-in from the mechanics. But prior to bringing the devices on, we got buy-in from the mechanics just from how much easier it made their job. Okay. Before we started using CMMS, we had an inventory storeroom, but we didn't, you know, we had labels on bin locations, but we didn't know what was in there. It wasn't kept, we didn't inventory it every year. It wasn't kept really accurate. People would take parts, wouldn't get on a work order. Even if it did get on a work order, it may not have been adjusted in the system. So it was really hard to keep it straight. But the worst thing was, you need a part, you pull a pump out, mm-hmm. you have to rebuild it. You have to open it up, first of all, to find out what parts you need. Then you need to go see if you have the part. Well, the system might say we had it. It's not in the bin. Well, now we're wondering, is it that we don't have any, or is it that it's in a different bin? Was it not put away? So we spent a lot of time looking for stuff. Once we put the CMMS in place, we had all of those parts, all of that entered into the system. Now we can pull up a parts list prior to pulling the pump out of service, so we can check to make sure that we have it in stock before we actually take it out. So operations can still use it until we get the parts in if we don't have them. But we have that parts list, we know where the part is, and we know whether or not it's in stock. So I got buy-in from the mechanics on that alone. Once they saw how much easier it made their life, so when the devices came along, that was just gravy.
Oh, so how long, what I'm curious about is, having worked with folks that do this already, how long did it take them to really realize the potential of the system? I mean, just approximately.
The benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It took us about 3 months after we started using it at the pump stations.
Right.
And it was because it took us that long. You know, we were collecting data, yeah. but we weren't really doing anything with it. And then we had another one of those instances where we needed a piece of information, and we found it right away. And that's what got us thinking about, geez, we need to use this everywhere, and started seeing some of the real benefits. So you can see, I mean, every department's using it now.
Just know that you can actually rely on the inventory numbers, that if it says a part is here, it really is. Mm-hmm. Is a really good feeling for the people that need to know if parts are here or not.
That's right. And, you know, we spot check. We set a goal of 15% of all of our parts to spot check them over the course of the year. But what the mechanics are doing is they'll pull a part off, they'll look at how many are left in the bin, and they'll compare that to the system. So we end up spot checking many more than 15%. And when it comes time to do that physical inventory.
And like the fact that they're doing that proves that they're enrolled in the system and they understand right. its value.
That's right.
Because they want the data to be
correct.
They're
owning it, man.
Yeah. That's excellent.
There was a lot of computer time entering data and that.
Up front, yeah, you bet.
You know, we even set up a little bank of computers for the maintenance guys because we spent too much time, you know, one guy on a computer and somebody standing behind him waiting for access to that computer. We did that to solve that problem. Then the tablets came along. Well, now there's nobody sitting at those computers a lot of the time, where it used to be somebody there most of the time. So there have been many other side benefits that we've seen. Up here you can see him doing condition assessment. You know, the device has a camera, so if there's something that he wants to show, it's real easy to snap the picture, and then that picture is automatically attached to the condition assessment form. Another thing it does for us is it gives him the sheets that show the criteria, how you rate a piece of equipment. So if you're rating it physically, you know, it's got a 1 means this, a 2 means this, so he's got something to look at, which greatly improved the consistency of the condition assessment ratings that we were getting. Before, we were concerned about, well, we should only have 1 or 2 people out doing condition assessment, because if you get 6 out there, you'll get 6 different ratings. Once we started using
the
devices...
Is the Yugoslavian judge theory?
Once we started using the devices, then that problem went away. Mm-hmm. And even on the landscape side, this is one area I did not expect to use it, but it's turned out to be a real blessing for us. We're able to document everything that we're doing landscape-wise and show that on a map or in a document. So it's really been a valuable tool to us. It's been spectacular. Even with everything else we accomplished in 2011, you know, finishing the condition assessment and all of that, this really is one of the biggest things that has come along. Saves us an incredible amount of time. So now you're probably asking yourself, well, where else is there to go? We've got to be done. Wrong.
Okay.
job security.
Now we're looking at how can we do what we're doing better, where before we were looking at what do we need to do in order to get to where we want to go. Now it's how can we get there faster? We want a faster car. So one of the things is establishing levels of service. We can do that now because we have condition assessment information. We have the historical information. We have the ops risk analysis on all of the assets. We need to set and implement the maintenance strategy and asset plans for all of the critical assets. And what that really means is the maintenance strategy is what are you going to do from now until the end of that life of that asset? What PM are you going to do? How often are you going to rebuild it? When does it come time? And then the asset plan is more like a cradle to grave. What are you going to do over the entire life?
Like what you showed for the Waukesha.
That's right. That's right. Actually, this one we are already doing, and that's where we combined our maintenance and our CIP, formed that multidisciplinary team to take a different look at all of the projects that we have and how we're going to deliver them. Is it going to be a maintenance project? Is it going to be an engineering or a construction project? We have, you know, packets of information that have led us to make the decisions that we make. So now, again, through the CMMS, with a couple of mouse clicks, we can pull down the entire package or just individual parts of the package to show, you know, quotes from vendors, condition assessment data, purchase orders, work orders, all of that's compiled in one location. So if anyone wants justification for something that we've done, we've got all of that on the computer. We can pull it up from any terminal. Tell me what you think.
Yeah. I need a web app.
I need another computer, Jason.
I, of course, think this is great, as I've always said every year, but I really appreciate your update because it's really exciting to see. I'll bet you at our next update you'll have even more applications and uses for it, just like the landscape thing that you will be thrilled about.
Now I'm wondering, well, what else is there? It seems like we've done just about everything. But
can you print remotely from the tablets?
We can.
Do you have to use a proprietary site to access, well, do you have to pay a hosting fee?
No. The only fee we pay, and we're only paying it on some of the devices, that's the data plans. And AT&T now recognizes this is a huge stream of data potential. So they've contacted us, and they're giving us discounts on the devices we purchase. They're giving us discounts on the data plans. You know, they see where this is heading. It's going to be. I can see the day where, you know, laptops are going to be a thing of the past. You're going to be carrying these devices around. You know, you get your email on there. You can do everything on there that you do on a regular laptop. But you know, like the Galaxy, you can put it in your back pocket.
Is it a 7?
It's a 7. They have the 10 now. We're not using those yet because we don't reach. So if we were to go to a pump station, we want to have access to SCADA, we couldn't do it.
You don't have any trouble with people dropping them if they can,
They're pretty good. I've dropped mine a couple of times. I'm just a little chip in the corner, but we've got some different cases that they go through. You know, it depends on how you're using it and what you're using it for. It determines what kind of case you're going to need. You know, operations need something that's a little bit more water resistant than what a mechanical need.
So,
talking
rain.
Yeah,
it's got to be able to float.
And then it floats away.
Just waterproof to 30 feet.
You
need to have a housing that's something similar to the tools used on a boat, you know.
I think this is such exciting stuff.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, and the thing about the devices, too, is we can get waterproof cases,
sure,
but it's 5 times the cost of a device. So,
really?
You know, we can afford to lose a device rather than make that expensive. Yeah. You know, so
we're heard him say that, Jason.
He won't allow us to lose a device.
So you have these systems, and you download it and you save it to what?
Everything is done on our network here,
okay,
regardless of where we are.
And then in the future, do you believe that the future tablets and the devices they use will be able to access this old technology? So you have this huge amount of data, but, you know, stored, but will the devices be able to?
See, right now I can access CMMS with the device. I can pull up work orders. I can process work orders. I can put labor on a work order from the device. It automatically goes to my timesheet. So we have all of that, all those modules, all that data, able to either on the device or from a computer terminal pull all that up. Mm-hmm. So we're
I just wonder if there's going to be a... I guess the analogy would be a DOS system versus, you know, what's out there now. And while you have a lot of data that's probably still under, you know, it could still be under an old system that you might have to access, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
Another analogy might be Microsoft Word or Excel or something. You know, I can't, some people can't open the more modern ones, but the more modern ones can always open the old ones.
Right, yeah, I know you can go, you can always go down, but you can't go right.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Very informative.
You'll be teaching this all over the United States.